So first of all, a few corrections, a few things that I wrote wrong yesterday. Let's start by this. I defined a scalar product, and I forgot a dagger. So please add a dagger there. This is an example of me trying to come up with an example and messing it up entirely. So this is not a possible state, because if the highest weight is 3/2, this is the spin 3/2 representation, there is no state with spin 1. These are all the possible states. And finally, yesterday I talked about the notion of an invariant subalgebra, but what I wrote was this definition, which is actually the definition of just a subalgebra. An invariant subalgebra is a subalgebra that has the property that if you multiply any of its elements with any element of the whole algebra, you still stay within the subalgebra. So please make this correction as well. And thanks to all the people who pointed these things out. Okay, this is ready. Okay, so let's see where we are right now. So, why are we doing all this? I said before, if you're not really interested in high energy physics, maybe you don't have to worry too much about this. Although it is useful, of course, in other fields. The main idea is that particles in nature are irreducible, fall under irreducible representations of certain Lie algebras. In particular, you know.
Yeah. They have to be of specifically Lie algebras?
I think so. I don't. What do you have in mind? That's a Lie algebra.
So an algebra of operators is a Lie algebra as well? Not necessarily.
A Lie algebra is what we define. The Poincaré group is a Lie algebra, for example. What other algebras?
Because I have in mind there are some quasi-particles in several models that are irreducible representations of operator algebras. But I don't know if those are Lie algebras or not, but maybe...
Let's talk about this later, because we really have to cover a lot today. So, okay. So when I write this, in particular, I have in mind that the standard model, as you may know, is an SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. We've already said what a U1 is. Yesterday, we studied representations of SU2. So I think that representations of SU2 is one thing you should all make sure that you understand. Please tell me if you don't. Send me an email, come and find me. I want you all to know how to do this. And today, we're going to do SU3. So we want to study these irreducible representations. Let me just make one more comment, because I think some people have been confused about this. We have been kind of using two approaches, but at the same time, we have been seeing that they are equivalent. One approach is say, let's just study Lie algebras. What I mean by this is let's write down anything that could be a Lie algebra. And this is what we did yesterday in class. So we started by talking about simple and compact Lie algebras, and then we said, what is the smallest, simplest Lie algebra? And we wrote down SU2s. So we wrote down the structure constants there by hand. So for example, as I said, what we called yesterday, the smallest algebra was what Cartan classified as U1. Okay. And we are going to continue along this line today. Now, the other approach is take a Lie group, find its generators, and find what kind of algebra these have to obey. So So you did this in the tutorial yesterday. You started from the group SU2. You found its generators. You found that they are the Pauli matrices or something that looks very, very much like the Pauli matrices. It depends on how everybody chose to parameterize their bases. And this is the, and you know that the Pauli matrices have to satisfy the SU2 algebra. And then you saw that these two things are actually the same. So we are going to continue along the same line. I am going to give you the guidelines of how to do this today. And then in the tutorial today, you are going to check that you can do the same thing for SU3 on this side and actually find the same algebra that we're going to call here A2. And so on. Okay, so a short review of the highest weight representations of SU2. We constructed things that we call spin J representations. So we started from a highest weight state, J. This is an eigenstate of the operator J3. And using our raising and lower operators, we went down to a state with eigenvalue J minus 1 and so on. And we saw that this can only go down to minus J. And I remind you that we chose our raising and lowering operators so that they are eigenvectors, and you're going to understand very soon why I call them eigenvectors of J3. And we said that J can only take half integer values. It can only be 0, 1/2, 1, 3/2, and so on. Very good. Now, one thing we saw yesterday, but maybe I didn't use the word for it, is the fundamental representation of SU2. This is just the spin 1/2 representation. It is called the fundamental representation because the group SU2 is defined as the group of 2x2 matrices. So the fundamental or defining representation for SU2 is the one which has 2x2 matrices. If you were choosing to follow this route, you would find the Pauli matrices and their algebra. This would be your defining representation. Then in the tutorial, you showed that the adjoint representation is equivalent to the spin 1 representation.
So the representation is the one whose dimension is the same as the dimension of the group.
Yes, very good.
Repeat that again.
Sorry, no. The dimension of the group, what do you mean the dimension of the group? The group is infinite.
The dimension of the algebra is a vector space.
So the number of
generators. That's the adjoint.
No, that's the adjoint representation.
So what is the definition of the fundamental representation?
So for SUN, the fundamental representation is, for SUN, this is n-dimensional. So we are talking, SUN is defined as the group of n by n complex matrices.
So the representation whose dimension is the same as the group members.
Sure, as You can say it's the same dimension as the dimension of the vector space on which the group elements are defined to act on. So this is n squared minus 1. And today we're going to do a lot of drawing. So what should I do this? So let me start by drawing the first diagrams. So I'm going to put the states of a certain representation of SU2 along a line, and this line is going to, this axis is going to be the weight. So I said that each eigenvalue of J3 is called a weight. Yes, I meant for the adjoint. The adjoint representation has dimension n squared minus 1. Sorry, thank you. Okay, so let me first put here the states of the adjoint. So this is a state, there is a state of weight 0, state of weight 1, and a state of weight minus 1. Right? Because the adjoint is the same as the spin 1 representation. Now, you might have already guessed that the adjoint is a very important representation. It kind of stands out of all representations. So in what we will do today, we will always kind of start from the adjoint and work from there. You will see. And now, for example, let me also put in the, so I should say purple, if you can see that this is purple, is the adjoint. How about the states of the spin 1/2 representation? They have weights 1/2 and minus 1/2. So some terms that you might have heard before is that if you have a state of weight plus 1, for example, it is a triplet under this SU2 because there are three states in this representation, whereas the half spin states are a doublet of SU2. This is why we use those terms. As an example, let me also draw the J3 half representation. So we're going to have 3/2, 1/2, minus 1/2, and minus 3/2. And again, I'm also going to put the adjoint here, minus 1, 0, and 1. So the one thing I want you to notice here and keep in mind is that the weights of the adjoint are always equal to differences in weights in other representations. So the weights of the adjoint are called roots. And they are always equal to differences of weights in other representations. Well, of course, in the adjoint as well. So if I go from 3/2 to 1/2, I'm subtracting 1 and so on. This is, again, something that generalizes to other algebras. So I'm going to describe our strategy now for finding other Lie algebras. But let me first ask if there is a question about this. Yes?
This is more relevant to the generalization, but are you always guaranteed that the differences of all the weights will find you all of the roots?
The differences of all of the weights will find you all of the roots.
Yeah, like if you just take in an arbitrary representation, and you look at all the weights, and then you take all the differences, are you guaranteed to find all the roots by that method?
No, because you will start, you can always start from the trivial representation that, which I didn't draw here. You can always have a singlet as well, right? Everything is one state. So there, for example, no, it doesn't work. We are actually going to go the other way. So assuming that we know the roots, if you know the roots, you can build all the weights. That's what we're going to do.
Sorry, what do you mean by difference of weights in the other representations? If I take two of the weights on a representation, gives me...
So, okay, I should have said the differences of two, of weights of states that are close to each other. So what this really means is that if you... The fact that this distance is one means that any distance between any two neighboring states in an SU2 representation is going to be one. This sounds trivial now because we already know this.
The difference between successive weights.
Successive states, and this means that in general, if you want to go from one state to the other, you need to apply an operator of the adjoint representation. We will see this. But yes, neighboring states here. Neighboring states here.
Excuse me, sorry. Yeah. What are the other names for the J equals 1/2 and J equals 3/2 representations?
You mean the doublets and triplets that I mentioned, or something else?
Well, what's the is the J equals 1/2 is also the fundamental representation, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
Let me write it here. So this is the fundamental. So this was all SU2. Now I'm going to describe your strategy for applying this construction to other more general algebras. So we first need to find a set. Sorry, this has to be a maximal set. So if you're given a set of generators, the first thing you need to do is find the maximum number of generators that commute with each other. For SU2, no generator commuted with the other, so you were free to choose anyone you wanted. Let's call these the, we're going to call them HIs. And depending on the algebra, I can take values from 1 to some number m. And this number m is called the rank of the algebra. So what is the rank of SU2?
One.
It's rank 1. This is what the index 1 in Cartan's classification implies. So I should have said these generators also have to be Hermitian. And as I said, well, they have to be commuting. I'm just rewriting the same statement here. This subset of the algebra is called the Cartan subalgebra. And we are going to refer to the HIs as the Cartan generators from now on. So once... Once we have this set, what we need to do is take one by one those HIs and treat them as a J3. So build an SU2 algebra for every one of those HIs. So pick one HI, say H1. It doesn't really matter. So now we have to find raising and lowering operators with respect to this H1. So we need to find operators. How do I denote those? Let's say X. We need to identify all generators or linear combinations of generators that will that will give us something like this. I mean, of course, outside the Cartan. Otherwise, this is going to be zero. And these are going to be our raising or lowering operators. Once we have them, we can construct a highest weight representation.
Question?
Yeah.
Raising and lowering implies some kind of linear ordering, mm-hmm. but is it possible to find sort of more than two sort of fundamental raising and lowering operators? Like, could you go raise and lower in different dimensions?
Yes. So you will raise and lower in different directions if you want. So you so we will see that basically once we generalize this to say SU3, we will add another dimension to those weight diagrams. So instead of a line, we're going to have a plane now,
right.
And maybe one operator will move us along this line, but another operator might move us along some other direction.
But then you can have for each one of these HI more than two lower or raising operators.
There are constraints on what you can have here. You will see.
When you say proportional, you mean with scalar proportionality?
Yeah, with scalar proportionality. I should some constant here. So now that I've written this, let me use the words from now on. X is an eigenvector of H1, and this constant of proportionality is the eigenvalue. You can think of H1 acting on X in this way. So once you have done this with H1, all you have to do is do the same thing for H2. However, as you will see, the constraint will be that if there is a state there, if you build one representation for H1, this every state in there needs to fall under a representation of H2 and under actually of a representation of all the Cartan generators in your algebra. This is why it is not possible to build infinitely many algebras like this. And Cartan actually classified all of them. So this is what we will be doing. And let's say we have done this construction and it is successful, then we will label our states. By their weights under each Cartan generator. So by a vector mu, let me write this mu 1, where HI acting on the state mu gives us UI. Right? So every state has to be an eigenstate of all the generators in the Cartan, and these are the eigenvalues. So this is called the, just 1 second, this is called the weight vector. Yeah.
A little bit confused. So I made the same process for H1, H2, until HM.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I build an irreducible representation for each of these
mm-hmm.
of this one. So the total representation of the algebra would be the direct sum of all of them, or
it will actually not. In some cases, it might turn out to be a direct sum. But in other cases, it will just be an irreducible representation of the whole group. This is why I'm saying you can't just take one generator, build a spectrum, then take the other generator, build a spectrum, and forget that you actually had an H1 there.
Right.
They need to be consistent with each other.
Okay.
So they are not just independent, not just direct sums. In some cases, you can also have direct sums.
Mu goes from 1 to n, or what?
Fm, I wrote here. Oh, no, I wrote
right.
M there, so I should be writing M here. M because M is the number of Cartan generators. So it should also be the number of eigenvalues. Okay, so before we move on and actually do this, we need to talk a little bit more about the adjoint representation. Because as I said, it's going to be very useful in this construction. So let me remind you again, we have defined the matrices and the adjoint to have entries minus I, F, A, B, C. Now, already somebody was asking yesterday, what vector space does this representation act on? So the natural space on which it acts on is actually the space of generators. So remember that our generators, let's call them XA. So these are all the generators in the algebra. They span a vector space. So let's use this vector space as the vector space on which these matrices act on. In other words, let's label states by XA. And let's assume this is also normalized. So that we can write the identity operator like this. Now, since this is a vector space, if you take linear combinations of these states, this is going to be exactly the state that corresponds to the linear combination of the generators, for example. Let's see now why it is natural for this representation to act on those states. Let's consider the action of TA on the state XB. And let's add the identity operator here. So let's rewrite this as XC, TA, XB. Now, this part is, by definition, the components of the matrix TA. That's TACB. Question?
When you say the XAs are normalized, with respect to what? Inner product?
Yeah, so let's assume that we have an inner product here and we normalize states like this.
What would be like?
The inner product should be. Do we need to specify this? We do have an inner product for the. For the generator, so we have defined this inner product. Now, how does this generalize here?
You can define the inner.
I'm thinking if this is. Okay, yes, you're right. So, define this to also be the inner product between XA and XB.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you. Yes, this makes sense. So where we have defined scalar products like this.
Is there some kind of normalization condition or something? Because if you take the inner product of XA, of itself, you can get one, right? But if you take the trace of, for instance, one and one, then you're going to get the dimension of the system, right?
Sorry, can you repeat that? Sorry.
If you take the inner product of an operator with itself, you should get one, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the trace, like suppose you take inner product of the identity,
mm-hmm.
you should get one, but you're going to get the dimension.
So we're going to normalize the identity to be one over the dimension.
Okay.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So by definition, TACP is minus IFACP. And now I can put this inside the state. But first, let me write it as IFACP XC. And if we are as long as we have a compact Lie algebra, remember that the structure constants are not only anti-symmetric in their first two indices, but in all three indices. So we can make cyclic permutations here, and this is IFABCXC. We also put the I inside the state. But this is the same as the commutator between XA and XB. So this is exactly what we wanted. The representation acting on this state gives us the, by definition, the commutator between the two generators. Do we see this? Yes.
Sorry, I'm still a little confused about this.
About this?
So to take that trace, you need to write down those generators in some
representation.
But won't that trace depend on like the dimensionality, for example, of the representation or something? So, I mean, how is that?
So, okay, so let's assume that we define a scalar product like this.
Okay.
Whatever the dimension of the representation is. We actually then choose our... Sorry, these equalities don't go in the best way. But anyway, this is a choice here. That this should be actually delta AB so that we have normalized vectors. So if you calculate the product between XA and XB, it's going to be some number. Well, take that number and divide XA and XB in such a way that you get 1. And also choose a basis in which they are orthogonal.
I just didn't hear what you're saying. That CA is just the annual scalar?
This C here is any scalar, yes.
Does that mean my states stay normalized even after I have some scalar in there?
That's a linear combination.
Sorry,
oh,
no. Only the generators themselves are normalized.
Oh, yes.
So one thing, so you said that we expected to have the commutator there because the adjoint is defined in terms of the constants,
mm-hmm.
right? Now, I'm a little bit confused on something. The TAs are just some matrices that had nothing to do with the XAs.
Well, TA is the representation,
okay.
is a specific representation
of
XA.
Okay.
It's the adjoint representation.
Right.
And this is just... This shows why it is natural to think of the TAs as acting on the XBs. Okay, now let's calculate the weights of the adjoint, which we called roots. So first of all, note that when a Cartan generator acts on another Cartan generator, it gives 0 because all the Cartan generators commute with each other, which means that the statement that Hi is a Cartan generator is equivalent to the statement that HI has a weight vector equal to zero. So in the adjoint of SU2, the zero state is the J3 state, yes.
Should HI be the like adjoint representation of the Cartan generator on the left-hand side of the equation far? Because
here, sorry,
our,
here?
The one you've just written here.
Yeah. This is in the adjoint, I mean, yeah.
And then from the adjoint into the, okay.
So this is all in the adjoint. So HI, HJ are the representations in the adjoint. Okay, maybe I shouldn't have introduced the T's and I should have just written X here. Yeah, that's better, okay. Okay, I don't have a problem with that. Very good. And now it's time to find eigenvectors of the Cartan. Yes.
Sorry, I'm a little confused about that weight vector.
Uh-huh.
You have mu vector equals mu 1 through mu
mm-hmm.
m or whatever. Is that index related to the mu I eigenvalue?
Yes, it is. It's the same. So this means that if I have I label my states by their eigenvalues under the Cartan generators. So this means that if I act with H1 on mu, where, let me write this explicitly. This is some mu 1, mu 2, up to mu m. I am going to get back mu 1 times my state. Let me now write it mu.
Oh.
Right? So for SU2, we only have one Cartan generator. Only one eigenvalue under it. It's the eigenvalue under J3. And we only need one number to label our states once we know which representation we're in.
So the point that you simultaneously diagonalize all of them, and then that's how you label them?
Yes.
Oh, OK. Now I understand. Thank you.
Because, very good, I should have said that. The importance in finding all the generators that commute with each other is in that we can diagonalize them at the same time. Thank you. This is why we're doing this.
So mm-hmm. why does spin Cartan implies the weight vector is zero and vice versa?
Because, so in the adjoint, right? Because the generators in the Cartan commute. So this means that this vector has eigenvalue 0 under any of the HIs.
OK, so that vector you have mu
mm-hmm.
over has anything to do with this vector HJ?
So this means that for a Cartan, so this is all for Cartan. I should write this. Mu is going to be 0, 0, 0. It's the same thing. Equals HI.
So the thing that we did was this only works for, like, you can only take the generators to be the basis of the vector space on which the generator is like, only in the adjoint.
Only in the adjoint, yes.
But now we're doing all of these things.
This is in the adjoint. All of this is in the adjoint.
So none of this carries over. I mean, we're not always interested in.
No. So what we're going to do is first study the root diagrams and then pass on to highest weight representations.
Okay.
If we add this adjoint operators in another vector space, we have.
You can, unless it's the same dimension, you cannot do it.
Okay.
Because this comes with a specific dimension. So you cannot take the adjoint operators and act on them with them on the spin 1/2 representation of SU2, for example.
But we should get the same result for this new vector.
If you're working on a representation of the same dimension?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, because that just means that you have labeled your states in a different way. It doesn't really mean they are different. I mean, these are the representations for SU2. That's what they are. You may want to call the states a bit differently, but that's what it is.
So the correct statement is that for Cartan generators in the adjoint representation, the weight vector is zero.
Is zero.
And
yes. Is
there any other representation in which there's no weight vector?
In which the weight vector is zero? Yes. For example, if I draw the spin 2 representation for SU2, I'm going to find something with zero weight there as well.
Okay.
But then I shouldn't be thinking of this as acting on this vector space. So there is no point in saying this state is corresponds to a generator in the Cartan or not. Just because the states don't correspond to generators.
That's only true in the adjoint.
That's only true in the adjoint, that they do correspond to generators.
Okay.
So all this blackboard is only true in the adjoint. Okay, so let's find eigenvectors of the adjoint. We expect them to be labeled by more than one indices again, because we have more than one Cartan generators. So I'm going to introduce a vector alpha here as the index of this generator E. And this is what I am looking for. Sorry.
Can you say again what that notation means? I'm sorry.
Okay, so I am looking for. I am looking for this. For something that has some. I'm looking for a state that is an eigenvector of Hi. And it's going to have some eigenvalue Xi. But I want this state to actually be an eigenvector of all the Cartan generators. So I'm going to have a set of eigenvalues, and I label them, I call them alpha i's.
Okay.
Does this make sense?
Since the Cartan are all mutually commuting, does that mean if some state is an eigenstate of one, it's going to be an eigenstate of every single one?
Yes. It means that you can work with eigenstates of all Cartan generators.
But if I have some state that's an eigenstate of some specific H1, say, is it guaranteed to be the eigenstate? Can I associate a number alpha I with the rest of the?
You should be, yes. So if you find one, if you find it for one, it should be for the others as well, since they mutually commute, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
This E alpha is in what representation?
The adjoint. Still in the adjoint. So everywhere where I'm going to talk about an operator E alpha as well. So wherever, you know, operators appear as operators and also inside states, this should be in the adjoint.
So finding those vectors E alpha will give us information about those X.
Yes, this is the axis. Yeah, this is what we are looking for. But now I'm just labeling them in a better way, because it's just not.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are we still working in the adjoint?
Yes, this is it. Still in the adjoint.
So is the weight vector zero?
I will let you know when when we are done with the adjoint.
Is the end of that question still?
Yeah.
So then it's a linear combination.
Okay, so. We are in the adjoint. This means that this left-hand side is basically the state formed by this commutator, so you may see that this statement is equivalent to saying that the commutator between I and E alpha is equal to alpha I E alpha. So these E alphas are eigenvectors of Cartan. Okay. A couple of things you can check. You can check that if I take an operator that is labeled by the opposite eigenvalues of the operator E alpha, this is going to be the adjoint of E alpha. So you can check this because I don't have time to show this, but it is in my beautiful notes that all of you have access to now. Also note that if the two sets of eigenvalues are not exactly the same, then these two eigenvectors are orthogonal. This is a property of Hermitian operators. Remember, Hermitian operators can be decomposed into their eigenstates can be made orthogonal. Which means that we can normalize these states as well. So that E alpha E beta is just delta alpha beta. This Kronecker delta means that alpha 1 has to be the same as beta 1, alpha 2 the same as beta 2, and so on. Okay, now, these are going to be our raising and lowering operators. Let's see how. Let's assume that we have a state mu. That is an eigenstate of our Cartan generators. And let's act on it with an E alpha, where E alpha is an eigenvector of Cartan. Then if you calculate the action of Hi on this, you will see that this will turn out to be mu I plus alpha I mu. So what this operator E alpha does is that it raises the weight of the states by alpha I. Question? It's in the adjoint, yes.
So now E alpha is acting on mu.
On mu, yes.
But
okay. No, you're right. This is not in the adjoint anymore, sorry. Or this can be anywhere. Okay, sorry. So this is the state that corresponds to the operator E alpha, but this operator E alpha can be represented in every other representation as well. It's just a generator. It's a linear combination, sorry, of generators. It's there. So let's say we don't know what mu is. Mu is some eigenstate of Hi, maybe in the adjoint, maybe in some other representation.
Okay.
Then this is true in any representation.
I see. Question. Shouldn't there be an E alpha?
Yes, there should be an E alpha here. So for mu being a state in some representation. maybe the adjoint, maybe another representation. Similarly, if this was minus alpha, there would have been a minus sign here.
So one thing, the weight vector is just a vector on the space where EHI acts?
So this, yes, if the state okay. there. The weight vector is really a vector.
Right. And here the EA alpha vector is just the one that I constructed through that joint representation. I mean, it's this one that it's in the upper one.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right.
So
the E alpha is in the adjoint.
So the state E alpha is a state in the adjoint. The operator E alpha is an operator. You can represent it in any representation.
So the thing is that we use that joint representation just to show that the Cartan generators satisfy this for any operator.
Yes.
Well, not any operator.
But we need to find.
Right,
yeah.
The ones that we want.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the adjoint representation does the trick.
That's the trick, yeah. And the main trick from here is that again, the roots are going to be differences of weights. So this state is a state in the adjoint representation. Alpha I is the weight of that state in the representation, so the root. That's why alpha I is called a root vector. And from this relation, you can see the same statement. Differences of weights are roots. It is easy to see that now, because the state in the adjoint corresponding to this operator has a root vector minus alpha, and E alpha raises that by alpha, the state that corresponds to this combination is a state of zero weight vector. So this state, if this state, to be precise, let me write this. This state has root vector zero. So it must be in the Cartan, which means that the commutator of these operators must be a linear combination of generators in the Cartan. And you can show, sorry, but we're running out of time, that the correct linear combination is the product between the vector alpha and the Cartan generators. This is there are a few lines there to show this. Yes.
Quick question back to the adjoint representation. If I have some state vector whose roots are zero, that's guaranteed to be
in the Cartan. Yes.
But we didn't show that.
I believe this can go backwards. So if you have a zero, if you have a zero weight vector, this means that you commute with all the operators
saying,
in the Cartan.
But that's just saying there is no other vectors.
Well, we have assumed that we have chosen the maximum number.
Okay.
of commuting generators.
Why does commutator has root vectors here?
Because this one has root vector minus alpha.
Right.
And this one adds an alpha to it. So what the operator, what E alpha does, I'm going to write this here because this is very important. E alpha raises the weight of any state by the vector alpha. And e to the minus alpha lowers the weight by alpha. So when you start finding these operators, you will see that every eigenvector, every root vector comes in two pairs. There's always an alpha and a minus alpha. So you can always build an SU2 there. And the correct normalization to get the actual SU2 is so E plus and E minus can be defined as 1 over the length of the vector alpha, E plus minus alpha, and if you define E3 to be alpha dot H, then you can check that this is exactly an SU3 algebra, SU2 algebra.
I still don't see why does it has the root vector 0 on it.
Okay, so let's do this calculation.
Or it's just because if I take that kit with the commutator into the adjoint, it's the same as putting E alpha applied to the vector E minus alpha so that it sums to each component the component of alpha and input.
Yes, but let me write it also for everybody. So what is E minus alpha in the adjoint? It is the state that when acted upon with HI gives back minus alpha I E minus alpha. So from here, we see that E minus alpha basically is the same as the state with root vector minus alpha. Mm-hmm. Right? I know there's a slight confusion here. So in general, we label states by their weight vectors. In the adjoint, in particular, we can also put in the operator in there. It's the same thing in the adjoint. Yes.
So this expression for the rising lambda operation, is that a sum over or just any alpha?
So this is for an alpha that is a root vector. So what you have to do is you have to solve this equation to find the eigenvectors and the alphas. So for one alpha that you have found, this is going to be correct.
So there'll be a range of different possibilities for different alphas.
Yes. Different SU2s. For every alpha, a different SU2. Yes.
One other question. So I'll have a whole bunch of H's in the car family.
Mm-hmm.
So we've written E alpha as an alpha vector. Would it make sense to be talking about like E1 plus E1 minus and E2 plus E2 minus, each one associated with an H?
It's a
bishop.
You mean
So each one is a finite vector of all of them. You can do that because they usually commute.
I'm not sure if that's what you were asking.
So for the alpha vector, the values that each component of that alpha vector could take would be...
corresponds to an eigenvalue of the vector E alpha with respect to each Cartan generator HI.
I see. Okay.
So E alpha acting on this state, I'm rewriting on the same thing, is E alpha acting on the vector minus alpha. And now let's calculate Hi acting on this. But from this relation right here, which is one of the probably most important equations, probably the most important equation on this blackboard is this one. You can see that this is minus alpha, because the mu there is just minus alpha i, plus alpha I e alpha on e minus alpha, and this is just zero. So this is a state of zero root vector. And from this we see that this operator, the commutator of E alpha with E minus alpha, must be in the Cartan. Okay. So let's go back to a general representation, and we have, and let's say we have a state of weight mu. Then what is the weight of this state under this, let's call it alpha SU2? In other words, if I act on it with E3 as I have defined E3 over here, what am I going to get? Sorry, there was a typo here. This should have been normalized by alpha squared. So this is going to be alpha dot h over alpha squared acting on mu. But h acting on mu just gives us the vector mu. So this combination here is the weight of this state under this particular SU2. But of course, we're going to have more than one SU2s. So you can characterize each state if you want under its weight by under a particular SU2.
Would it be, or just to help me understand, would it be wrong to label the E plus minuses and E3 to give them like an alpha index or something?
Yeah.
So now it's
It would be mostly correct. I can do it now if everybody's fine with it. I just didn't want to put more in this. But yes, because for every SU2, you will have a different E3 and a different E plus minus. So this is what I've called the alpha SU2.
Okay.
Let me just say this is for alpha.
The different alphas, they correspond to different representations?
No. They correspond to different eigenvectors of the Cartan generators.
Yes.
So
an alpha SU2 is what?
Sorry, alpha is what?
So when you wait under alpha SU2, is it under a particular representation of SU2?
So let's say, for example, that we find two eigenvectors, alpha 1 and alpha 2. Then we can build two SU2 subalgebras of our algebra.
Okay, so they're different subalgebras.
They're different subalgebras of the algebra, yes.
And here you pick the particular alpha, right?
I have, let's say I have one alpha, and this is, and as I said, let's assume that we have some representation. This is a state in that representation. Remember, this is a representation of the whole algebra. not just of this SU2. And just remember that this is an SU2, so its states should really form every state in this spectrum, in this representation, should definitely fall under a representation of this particular SU2. And every representation is going to have a highest weight. So all the arguments that we used for SU2 yesterday hold. The highest weight can only be a half integer, and in particular this alpha mu over alpha squared can also needs to be a half integer as well. And there must be a highest weight state for this, I mean here for this particular, for the alpha SU2. And let's say that this state will have, let's label this as mu alpha. Then notice that the difference between the state mu, between the vector, between this weight and the weight of the highest weight state under this SU2 has to be an integer. You can only move integer steps from one state to the other. So if I label J the highest weight, so if this is J, then you can show this, that and I will tell you what P and Q are. P is the number of steps that you need to take to go from the state mu to the highest weight state, and Q is the number of steps you need to take to go from mu to the lowest weight state. So this must be true for every state. So this means that E plus to the P acting on mu takes us on mu alpha. Let's say this is a maximum. And E minus acting Q times on it takes us to mu minimum. Bear with me because I'm about to tell you something very important. Let's see what we don't need here. Okay, now let's go back to the adjoint. And let's say that we also have another eigenvector that we call E beta. So beta is another root vector. Since this is a state in the adjoint, then a relation like this I should be able to apply this for beta. So this means that I must be able to write that alpha dot beta over alpha squared must be equal to minus 1/2 times the difference of two integers. P minus Q.
Anna?
Yes.
Can you say one more time what the P and Q mean? So P is the number of times you have to apply.
So P So this state is some state in an SU2 representation. It means that I must have, within an integer finite number of steps, I must be able to get to the highest or the lowest weight state.
Okay.
And I am labeling those numbers of steps as P and Q. The important thing is that they are integers. This is what we are going to use. Yes.
So the numbers P and Q by themselves depend on the state mu that each does.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
And they and the precise numbers are not going to matter for what we are going to say now.
Sure.
But the important thing is that such a relation is must be true. Yes.
This is a different data than the alpha. Why do we assume that we're using the same basic model?
So in the in every representation we build, So in every representation, every state that is there must satisfy this relation. So every representation you build, you can think of it as many SU2s. Okay. So now let's think of the adjoint representation in particular. So beta is a state in this adjoint representation. It has to transform somehow under the alpha SU2. Maybe it's a doublet, a singlet, you don't know. But this must be true for it.
But the beta in the adjoint representation, it's also a weight vector?
A weight vector is called root vector in the adjoint, yes.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, because here I have alpha mu. And you have their alpha beta.
Yes, so I'm using beta as my mu now. I'm applying that relation. I'm applying this to the state E beta, which is a state in the adjoint. Okay? But since this is a state in the adjoint, I could have built an SU2 on that state. Is a beta SU2. And if alpha is a root vector, then alpha has to be a state under this SU2. This is very important. This is where all the constraints come. Yes.
So the P's and the Q's are necessarily the same for the two of
them. Exactly. So let me rewrite what now this star relation implies for alpha as a state in the SU2 of beta. This is going to have some different P's and Q's there. But the important thing is that these numbers are integers. From these two relations, we see that if we actually think of alpha and beta as vectors, then the angle between the two of them, the cosine of this angle, has to be a quarter times these differences of integers. This is extremely constraining. Since these things are integers, the values that this product here can take are basically 0, 1, 2, 3, and 4. It cannot be 5 because the cosine cannot be greater than 1. So there are 5 possible values here. Times a quarter, 2 quarters, 3 quarters, 4 quarters. So this is extremely constraining. It says that you can only have very specific angles between root vectors in the adjoint representation.
So a little detail, the P's and Q's are positive integers.
They are positive integers because they are literally numbers of steps.
This is give us a justification for why we call them root vectors. Is it because they're sort of roots on a circle?
I guess so. I don't know. I don't know why they were, to be honest. Yes.
I have two different vectors, mm-hmm. right? Alpha and beta.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them have their own copy of SU2
mm-hmm.
of algebra,
mm-hmm.
right? So why does one vector needs to be a vector under the other algebra?
Because if we are using states that are all eigenstates of the Cartan generators.
Okay. So
yes.
It's just because I can go from alpha to beta by applying this.
Yes. So if you start with a state mu.
Right.
If mu is some state in your representation, you the operator E alpha is there, and you can act on it. So where is this going to take you? It should take you inside the representation. If it takes you outside the representation, you have failed. And this is basically the constraint.
Mm. Right. Okay. So beginning with alpha and applying successive Cartan operators with the E alpha, I can go to beta, basically.
Basically, that's what this says, yes.
Right.
Applying E alpha or E beta operators.
Yeah, okay.
So this says that, let me be very specific, the angle between the two vectors can be, these two choices are easy. They say it's 0 or 180 degrees. This is kind of obvious. We always have 0 means that the two vectors are the same, or that you have the vector minus alpha, for example. But we know that we always have that, because we said here that E minus alpha is also an eigenvector of HI. The other option, let me not get this wrong. Okay, so we can have 30 degrees angles, 45 degrees angles, 60 degrees, 120 degrees, 135 degrees, 150 degrees, and I don't think I missed anything. That's all. So these are all the possible angles between two root vectors. So if you want to classify Lie algebras, all you have to do is draw the root diagrams for their adjoint representation. So you have to use these rules to try to find all the possible Lie algebras. And the rules are any two root vectors can only be separated by one of these angles. And every state has to belong to all the SU2s. So if you start adding alpha and beta vectors to different states, you should always stay within the representation.
What if you had more algebras than possible angles? Does that mean some of the algebras that we would have the same root?
Very good. So this is the angle between two vectors. Obviously, on the two-dimensional plane, we can only have two independent vectors.
Yeah.
Right? So you have to start thinking about three dimensions then if you want to add a third vector, and that's how you make higher rank representations. So rank one algebras can be put on a line. Rank two algebras can be put on a plane. Rank three algebras, you'd have to start doing three-dimensional things. And then there are some other tools that are based on this idea to classify Lie algebras. Unfortunately, we don't have the time to do this, but I do invite you to look at Georgi to see this. Just one thing. In the tutorial today, first of all, I have the tutorials here, and I want you to take them, because if you have time in the break, I'm happy if you start looking at them earlier. Okay, let me not say this yet. Yes, your question.
Good question. So it seems that these angles that we got heavily dependent on how we chose to normalize minus and plus E3. Did we have any choice?
So E3, E plus and E minus have to normalize like this in order for us to get this SU2 algebra. So we shouldn't have any, you know, square root of alpha squared here or anything like that. So you can check that you have to make this choice. In order to get the SU2 algebra, this is a choice that you have to make. And similarly, when you build the beta SU2, you will have to, so you will have an E3 for beta that will be beta times H over beta squared and so on.
One other thing, if we go to rank 3, does it necessarily mean we have to go off the plane? Or
you have to, because on the plane, so what I haven't clearly said yet is that basically the problem of finding these algebras comes down to drawing vectors. It really comes down to that. And on the plane, you can have up to 2 linearly independent vectors. You cannot do anything other than that.
You have to
remember that if, for example, if you act with E alpha on E beta, you're going to get a state that is proportional to alpha plus beta. So if I draw the root vector of this, it's going to be a linear combination of the others. On the plane, you can only have 2 vectors, nothing more.
I think you've forgotten 90
degrees. What did I forget? Sorry. 90 degrees. Oh, the easiest one. Thank you.
Question?
Yes.
So any Lie algebra can be constructed by specifying these angles. Is that right?
That's you have to specify the angles and the lengths of the vectors. You have to specify. Once you don't have many choices. Then yes, the angles are actually yes. The angles are enough. Sorry, you're right. Yes.
And can you reiterate the importance of SU2? What does it mean to say it's the fundamental building block of all these things?
Okay, I wanted to talk a little bit of about SU3 as an example of this. So I think you can stay another 5 minutes. You can't be hungrier than me. So, so can you pass this around? So while these are going around, I have to say the tutorial is here. You can take it. Actually, you might as well take it now. The tutorial is mainly SU3. I do believe that a lot of this is for those who are interested specifically in high energy physics. For this reason, I have already uploaded on the wiki a Mathematica file with the solutions for this tutorial. If you want to come to the tutorial and start looking through the solutions, that's okay with me. I really care that you understand this. Rather than you're able to do it by yourself within 2 days. And also, if you are not that interested in it, please memorize this page. So let's see what happens with SU2. SU3, sorry. So SU3 is one of the possible algebras of the possible rank 2 algebras, which means that everything is consistent if I make the following choice for 2 root vectors on the plane. This would be, let's call this alpha 1 here. This is 1, 0. And this is alpha 2, which should be -1/2 square root of 3/2. So if I choose these 2 vectors, they have an angle of 120 degrees between them, and they both have a unit length. I can actually build a consistent spectrum. So there are 2 SU2s here. One is the SU2 with respect to this root vector. So the easiest thing is to start on its axis. So I get three states here. This is the adjoint of SU2. How about the adjoint of this SU2? I'm going to have a state here. And I get a second state in the center. That's why we usually draw a circle. And then I'm going to get a state right here. So in order to go from here to the origin, I am acting with E minus alpha 2 on this state. And this always adds a minus alpha 2 to my weight vector. So this was alpha 2, it takes me to 0. This state here is going to be minus alpha 2, because I have acted on it again with a minus alpha 2. Now, I should be able to act on, say, this state with an E alpha 1 as well. This will just take me over here. So this is E alpha 1 plus alpha 2 state. And in the same way, you can see that we should also get the minus alpha 1 minus alpha 2 state here. And these are all the states in the adjoint. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 states. And this is the number of generators for SU3. The two states in the center, the circle and the bigger circle, correspond to the two Cartan generators of this algebra. So you will see this in the tutorial. The SU3 algebra has, you can find a maximum number of two commuting generators. This is, sorry, one second. This is a rank 2 algebra. And this is why we see two generators here, yes.
Sorry, are there two states in the center?
There are two states in the center.
Can you reiterate how you got two states? Like, what does it mean?
So waving my hands here, I got them by saying that I have two SU2s. I shouldn't count this one as a third SU2 because it is just a linear combination of the others. You could have chosen to say use these two vectors as a starting point. I'm just saying this as an aside, but I have chosen these two vectors. So this is one SU2, and this is another SU2. This SU2 has an operator, a Cartan operator here. This SU2 has another Cartan operator. So there is an H1 and an H2 in the center.
I'm completely lost. So I know that for SU3 you have 8 generators and it's supposed to be 2 copies of SU2, but I cannot
It is not just 2 copies of SU2.
Well, it's a rank 2.
It's a rank 2 algebra.
But how can I know?
Well, you will see this in the tutorial. I'm not saying you should know this by now, but I'm telling you the answer just to see an example. So for example, this state is a triplet under this SU2. There are three states. What is it under this SU2, this state? So I can act on this state with an E alpha 2 or an E minus alpha 2 operator. Look at this. If I act with an E alpha 2 operator on this state, a third color. I go there. If I act on it with an E minus alpha 2, I am out. This is how I have defined the action of operators here. And you will check that this actually works with the SU3 algebra. So under this SU2, there's one SU2 here. Under this SU2, these two states here form a doublet. So this state here has weight 1 under this SU2, and it has weight 1/2 under this SU2.
Can you say that again, please?
Sure. This state here has weight 1 under this SU2, and it has weight 1/2 under this SU2. So I can transport this SU2 over here let's say this is a parallel line, I just have two states. These two states form a representation of SU2. Let's say this would be the perhaps the 1/2, and this is the minus 1/2 state.
Is it if you like take these two and project them down onto this line?
So the precise way to see the weight would be to calculate this. This is the weight of this state under that SU2. So the weight of the state alpha 1 under the alpha 2 SU2 is alpha 2 dot alpha 1 over alpha 2 squared. This is 1/2, you can check. This is a hexagon. You know, it's like projecting it here, this is 1/2.
So in the more general case, where, for example, in three dimensions, I have these three copies of SU2.
Mm-hmm.
But also if I cut, two planes that cut through those of those vectors will define me a line that corresponds to another lower dimensional representation of SU2.
Perhaps. I'm not sure I get exactly the picture that you have in mind.
I have the other line. I mean, I have the SU2 that crosses through the origin, right?
Uh-huh.
And I have these two other states that correspond to an SU2 with a lower representation, right? What I'm asking is, at higher dimensions, this is also the case.
It is going to be the case. So you can take this line and parallel transport it to into another dimension, and again, you should have SU2s under this there.
Okay.
I have a couple of quick questions. So the fact that you say that one is a doublet and this one's a triplet is only true when you're talking about the adjoint representation. I mean, does it, like, I could always consider not the adjoint representation in the higher dimension. Would that mean just I would just expand this thing and go to the new highest weights with the same angle?
So now this thing is called a root diagram, and it represents the weight vectors in the adjoint representation. So indeed, this state is a state in the adjoint. I can only talk about it in the adjoint. We also draw weight diagrams. So the adjoint is not the only representation. So one thing, and I am asking you to do this in the tutorial, so one thing you will do is to draw these other representations that I gave you here. So for example, if you look on one of the two pages, I have drawn for you the fundamental representation of SU3. Now, and I have still drawn the two SU2s. So one is the solid line, the other one is the dashed line. So the fundamental representation of SU3 has three states. Now, for example, I have drawn this starting by this state. I have taken this to be my highest weight state. Let's see, under this SU2, this is a spin 1/2 representation. This is a doublet.
Right.
However, under this SU2, this is a singlet. If you take a line from here, it's going to be a 90 degrees line. So I can put this here, but please don't be confused. These are two different root diagrams. And actually, I'm not even sure. So one should be. So these are the states in the fundamental representation. So the SU2s, again, transport here. This SU2 comes here. And these two states form a doublet under this SU2, for example. But this state under this SU2 is a singlet. It has zero weight under this SU2.
In principle, I could extend that to my highest weight, whatever that means.
Exactly. So again, so here I have given you four things. One is the adjoint, the fundamental, then what I guess some people might call the anti-fundamental. Anyways, you can also construct another representation with three states, and then I've given you a representation with six states. Actually, in the Mathematica file, you can find a code to construct any weight representation you want. You can fill this with dots everywhere. And this is important because we believe that, you know, quarks and gluons and mesons and so on fall under these representations. So, okay, let me just check that I didn't want to say anything other too important. I guess I can say it in the tutorial if I have. Thanks for your patience. Thank you.